Radio Prague News.
The post of Minister of Foreign Affairs, vacant since June, may finally be filled next week. Czech archaeologists have found the grave of a top official from Egypt's 5th dynasty, and Prague Zoo experts are searching for a missing deadly pet green mamba. The Social Democrats' nominee for the post of Foreign Minister, Tomáš Petříček, should be installed in the post late next week, according to the Prime Minister. The post has been vacant since June. Mr. Petříček, currently the Deputy Foreign Minister, is due to meet President Miloš Zeman on Thursday. The head of state had refused to appoint the party's previous candidate for the post. The Czech Republic is sending 10 million crowns worth of aid to help victims of the earthquake and tsunami that recently hit Indonesia, Deputy Foreign Minister Tomáš Petříček said. Dispatching monetary aid above that amount must be approved by the Czech government. The funds will be sent to Indonesia via local branches of humanitarian organizations, such as the Red Cross. According to Mr. Petříček, the Czech Republic also wants to help rebuild the hardest-hit areas. Stricter mortgage rules, in force since October, apply not only to new contracts, but also to refinancing existing housing loans. This according to the business daily Hospodářské noviny, citing a central bank spokesperson. According to the report, this is in direct contradiction with what the central bank governor, Jiří Rusnak, said in June, taking some commercial lenders by surprise. Czech Egyptologists have discovered the grave of an official from the 5th dynasty, thought to have been a custodian of royal affairs. The Czech research team, under archaeologist Miroslav Barta, also found a granite sculpture. Egypt hopes that the new finds will help boost tourism, which has slumped since the so-called Arab Spring. The National Prize for Architecture has been awarded to the Sporadical Studio for the new sports hall at Dolní Břežany Primary School. Judges said that the circular building, which mirrors its surroundings, cleverly masks its dimensions. Over 160 ateliers with projects implemented in the Czech Republic had entered the 25th year of the competition. Czech tennis player Karolina Plíšková has advanced to the third round of the Beijing Open for the third consecutive year, with a 6-3, 6-4 win over Alexandra Sasnovic of Belarus. The seventh-seeded Plíšková, who trailed 2-0 in the second set before winning four games in a row, will next play local wildcard entry Wang Cheng. Police have called in specialists from the Prague Zoo to help track down a pet mamba gone missing in the Hlubočepi district. Due to the cool weather, the deadly snake is likely seeking shelter in the heated building. Police were alerted to the situation after the reptile's apparent owner sought medical treatment for a snake bite. And finally, the weather. Thursday should be partly cloudy throughout most of the country, with rain in the forecast for the region of Liberec. Daytime highs should be between 13 and 17 degrees Celsius. I'm Brian Kennedy. That's the news for now.
Hello and welcome to Radio Prague, the international service of Czech Radio. Coming up in today's program, the Czech Republic hails the European Council's decision to let member states apply reverse charge VAT. We also hear about the exciting discovery Czech Egyptologists have made near Cairo, and later we will be treated to stories of incest and madness as author Mark Sloker discusses his upcoming memoir with Brian Kennedy. All that coming up, so please stay with us. The European Council on Tuesday approved a proposal that will allow EU member states that have a problem with carousel tax fraud to apply a generalised reversal of VAT liability. This is something Czech Prime Minister Andrej Babiš has fought for 4.5 years, on the argument that use of reverse charge could save the EU a large part of the around 170 billion euros lost every year in unpaid VAT. Daniela Lazareva looked into the story.
The Czech Republic loses more than 80 billion crowns in unpaid VAT every year as a result of sophisticated tax scams and carousel fraud. This involves importers bringing in goods free of VAT, selling them with the tax added, and disappearing without paying the VAT to the local tax office in the given country. Carousel fraud refers to a chain of companies involved in an intra-community supply of goods, where the goods are traded among VAT payers and some place in the chain the VAT is neither declared nor paid, and the respective economic subject ceases to exist or becomes untraceable. They are hard to detect since they frequently jump from one area of business to another. For years, the Czech tax authorities have been more or less helpless in fighting this type of tax fraud, and Prime Minister Babiš, formerly the country's finance minister, believes that reverse charge, where the tax is paid by the consumer and not the seller, is the most efficient way to get on top of the problem. However, winning approval for the Czech Republic to have the widest possible remit to use the so-called reverse charge VAT has not been easy. Brussels has a mandate to work towards tax unification within the European Union, and some member states have been lukewarm on the idea. Now, the Council has agreed to allow temporary derogations from normal VAT rules in countries where VAT fraud is a serious problem. Member states will be able to use the generalized reverse charge mechanism only for domestic supplies of goods and services above a threshold of €17,500 per transaction, and only up until June 30th of 2022, when the outcome of the exemption will be reviewed. Countries which wish to apply reverse charge will also have to meet strict technical requirements. Finance Minister Alena Schillerová told reporters on Tuesday the Czech Republic would make the widest possible use of the exemption.
The introduction of a generalized reversal of VAT liability is something we have pushed for 4.5 years. We believe it will be an effective instrument against carousel fraud without harming small and medium-sized businesses.
Critics are not so optimistic. They argue that the big tax fraudsters will always be a step ahead, and that the introduction of the reverse charge mechanism will not only mean changes to legislation, but will be an added administrative burden on VAT payers, who will be bound by electronic reporting obligations from which they were hereto exempted. Tax experts likewise warn that adding more and more exemptions to areas where reverse charge will now apply will make the VAT system increasingly complicated, which in turn will provide new opportunities for fraudsters. The Council's decision will have to be approved by the European Parliament and the Parliament of the Czech Republic before the Czech Finance Ministry can officially request to introduce a generalized reversal of VAT liability in this country.
That was Daniela Lazareva with that report. Now, a team of Czech archaeologists have made a remarkable discovery at Abusir near Cairo, unearthing a unique burial complex of an Egyptian dignitary dating back to the 5th dynasty of the Egyptian Old Kingdom. The limestone tomb is located in the center of a pyramid field, where only members of the royal family and the highest state dignitaries of the time were buried. Ruth Frankova has more.
Czech archaeologists have conducted work in Egypt for nearly 60 years, making a number of significant discoveries in the area of Abusir, a vast necropolis from the Old Kingdom located south of Cairo. Their most recent find, the uncovering of a tomb of the royal confidant and priest Kairos, was announced by the Egyptian authorities this week. Miroslav Barta, the head of the Czech Archaeological Mission in Egypt, explains what makes the discovery so unique.
In this case, there are actually multiple unique facts. The tomb is located in the center of a regular pyramid field in Abusir, dating back to around 2400 BC. Besides the cult chapel itself, it contains several other rooms. Another unique feature is that its chapel is the only royal tomb from this period using basalt blocks for paving, wall paneling, and the altar. This is evidence of the exceptional status of the tomb owner.
To je věc, která je naprosto výjimečná člověka.
Among the items discovered in the burial chamber of priest Kairos are parts of the decoration of the chapel depicting scenes from everyday life, as well as ceramic objects which were included in the burial equipment. But perhaps the most important find is a granite statue depicting Kairos sitting on a small chair. According to Czech archaeologists, it proves that ancient Egyptians placed statues into their burial chambers, a question they have been trying to answer for years. Although the burial chamber of Kairos had been looted already in antiquity, the statue has been miraculously preserved in its original location. It bears remnants of colours as well as engravings of titles which indicate Kairos's exceptional career. Miroslav Barta again.
To put it simply, Kairos was overseeing all the king's building projects and was described as his sole friend. He was responsible for the king's routine at the morning house, where he would come in the morning to wash, get dressed and have breakfast. He was also the inspector of the priests and the priest of the goddess Hathor, so he had all sorts of duties, but we can definitely say that he was really close to the king.
Another unique feature of the tomb is the construction of the burial chamber, which was built in an open pit. After the sarcophagus had been lowered and the side walls lined with limestone blocks, the chamber was closed by several giant ceiling blocks of limestone, each of which weighed at least 8 to 9 tons. Czech Egyptologists will continue with their research of the tomb in Abusir for another few weeks. It will take them another year or so to analyze all the items discovered at the site.
And that was Ruth Frankova ending that report. Now, just a reminder that you are listening to Radio Prague, the international service of Czech Radio, where it's now time for our main feature of the day. Novelist and essayist Mark Sloka, who is a guest author at the ongoing Prague Writers' Festival, was born in New York to Czech refugees who never should have married, but stayed together for nearly half a century. For a time, their chaotic lives, often distorted to tell a greater truth, provided rich fodder for his fiction. When both were gone, his father dead, his long-estranged mother suffering from dementia and Alzheimer's, he found the courage to search for the true story behind her descent into madness. The Czech version of the resulting memoir called Nobody's Son is out this week. Brian Kennedy talked to Sloka about the book and the inspiration behind it.
In the spring of 2014, the invisible world decided to put in an appearance. I couldn't move, couldn't laugh, couldn't write. I didn't know what was happening. The novel I was writing kept twisting like a heliotrope toward betrayals I'd never intended my characters to feel.
It had been a little over a year since his father died when Mark Sloka wrote that passage in what would become his memoir. He had also lost his mother, though she would live a couple more years, her mind having long ago lost any trace of him. For some 20 years, the American novelist and essayist, the only child of Czechs who had fled their homeland after the communist coup of 1948, had been writing about his parents, indirectly, hiding the three of us in fiction, story after story, book after book.
Looking back, I see that I stretched and pulled their story because it was too much for me then, too vast a canvas, and because I thought no one would believe it if I wrote it straight. Fiction would allow me to shape the deeper truth. This is what I told myself. Maybe it's true, but I'm older now. My mother's gone, and I'm less concerned with being believed. It's time to settle up with memory, square what can be squared, come to terms.
An overpowering listlessness had come to define his days, while his nights were full of relentless, exhausting dreams, as obvious as a club. The nest of memories, sacred and profane, wonderful and dark, the truths, hidden narratives told and retold, the fictions he had written for others and told himself far longer. All of these, finally, had to be untangled.
I think I didn't have the courage early on. My parents were both still alive, first of all. And I didn't have the courage to actually face it straight. I kind of hid my parents and their history and their life and their troubles, their marriage, their exile. I hid all of these things in fiction, and that kind of distorting mirror that fiction is. At some point, interestingly enough, around the time my mother's memory had lost all trace of me, or she slipped into dementia and Alzheimer's at the end of her life. Around that time, I ran into a kind of a wall in my life, and I realized, actually my wife pointed it out to me, she said, you know, you need to deal with this, you need to deal with that that thing that's stopping you now. I realized I had to tell her story, their story. This is a woman who I loved in a sort of unqualified way as a child, and as she got older, her own demons started to drag her down, and she basically tried to take me with her. So we had a very difficult relationship, but it wasn't until I was almost 60 that, you know, it was time to come to terms. It was time to look that in the face and say, either I do this now, or I'm going to live out my life talking to ghosts, arguing with ghosts, trying to get her approval, trying to understand why she was the way she was. I need to clean house now. I don't think it's a coincidence that only a year after I wrote this book, I moved to Prague. I think I was finally able to do that. Before that, I think this whole country was kind of shadowed by my relationship with her.
Mark Sloka's father was 17 when he joined the anti-Nazi resistance without telling his father, who himself had also joined in secret. His mother's father had been a Nazi sympathizer who had barely escaped death when the war was over. They married in June 1945, in haste, when he was a cub reporter for the newspaper Lidové Noviny, not yet 22, and she all of 19. Within a month of their wedding, her mother had arranged for an abortion.
The original sin at the center of this thing was what happened to my mother, whose father, František Kubík, was essentially a Nazi sympathizer during the Second World War, roundly hated by his neighbors, partly because he shot their cats. He was he loved birds, so he would shoot the neighbors' cats. When the cats came into the yard, he'd shoot them, and then he'd throw the bodies over the fence. Naturally, everybody in the neighborhood hated his guts. He didn't care. He had a little Hitler mustache for a while, sort of as a way of, I guess, signaling his sympathy. But this is also a man. I was able to piece all the pieces together through the act of writing this book to figure out what it was that was tormenting my mother all those years, what it was that changed her from the person I knew as a child to the person she became by the time I was 15. And I realized that the thing that she'd been carrying inside herself all those years was, well, there's no way to put it delicately, was sexual abuse, the monster of incest with her father. This was at a time when you didn't confess these things, you didn't talk to anybody about these things, you just buried it. The only person who knew was her own mother, who walked in on her husband and her daughter. And literally within a month or two of that moment, which strangely enough happened in the spring of 1945 as the war was ending, my mother was basically packed off and married to my father. I had to put all these pieces together like a detective. I had nothing. I had no hard facts, but I had mountains of circumstantial evidence that I'd never dealt with, never looked at, never wrestled with. If this gets any uglier, then, and the book as a whole isn't an ugly book, I actually think of it as an act of love, as a way of reconstructing love that had been hurt by all those decades. But first you had to get there, I had to mine through some pretty awful stuff, one of which was that within 2 months of marrying my father, my mother had an abortion. She never told my father. There's every reason to think that the child was not my father's, that the reason this happened so quickly is the abortion was absolutely necessary. My father was simply trotted out, the janitor's son. He was just a boy that my mother had been seeing. There was no particular reason for them to get married, but man, it was arranged at lightning speed. You know, and then a 46-year marriage followed. It's a complicated tale.
That complicated tale, as with others in Nobody's Son, does not unfold as a straight story. Some aspects loop back as they ripple through time. Others appear as passages of his fiction, chosen for what they revealed to the writer himself many years later, or for the truths he wished to convey at the time. In broad strokes, though, the chronology is as follows. His parents, Zdeněk and Olga, who never should have married, escaped across the Czech border in the winter of 1948 with the aid of a professional smuggler. After a year and a half in an Austrian refugee camp, then shoveling coal and cleaning toilets in Australia for some months, and spells in Washington, D.C. and New York, where Mark was born in 1958, the family eventually settled in suburban Pennsylvania. and his mother's descent into madness began.
My mother loved me when I was young, in that bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh kind of way, which leads so easily to betrayal. She came to hate me as I grew older. You could see it in her face, hear it in her voice, which was like watching someone you love draw a razor down their arm to hurt you. There are harder things than being hated by someone who loved you once and not knowing why, but not many.
In Mark Sloka's youth, he and his mother weren't just close, he writes. We were in league with each other. Soulmates, a church of two.
It's not surprising that it took my mother so long to teach me to hate her, or that when I learned it at last, I embraced it like an apostate drowning his doubt. The hate that replaces love is always a violent thing. To rip out those roots, you have to reach deep, get a good grip, close your eyes and pull. Ignore that strange loosening in your chest.
She instilled him with a love of literature as a boy, asking him why such and such a character in a story had said this or done that, what I thought they really wanted and why, and whether they knew it themselves.
If you could tell me a little bit about your mother's influence on you becoming a writer. You said you started writing 10-year-old stories about disappearing into the woods, but that your mother trained you in paradox and contradiction, and that she was, at that same age, asking you a lot about essentially what do you think the inner monologue of the character was, and were they aware of it themselves and that kind of thing?
Yeah, it was like a game we played. My mom was, she was an amazing reader, adored literature. She was a librarian for most of her adult life. She just loved writing, what she considered good writing, but she also had tremendous respect for the act of writing, again, for what she would think of as sort of serious writing or good writing. One of her cornerstone sort of beliefs, which enabled me to write this book, which says some hard things about her and grapples with who she became. One of her cornerstone beliefs was, you know, if you're going to call yourself a real writer, then by God, write what you need to write. Don't flinch. And if you're going to flinch, then don't write. Do something else, you know, go in another line of work, become a politician, I don't care, anything, but don't write. And so when it came around to writing this book, I had to ask myself, do I have what it takes to look at everything, to look at our family, at how it disintegrated, at some of the uglier sides of things? And the answer was, yes, I do, because I kind of heard, ironically, I heard my mother's voice saying, write it. If you're going to do it, write it. Don't ask permission. Don't look behind you. Don't get a map, you know. And if you do it to your satisfaction, if you do it as well as you are capable of doing it, then the reaction to the book is secondary. That's not important. That's not up to you. What you can control is the act of writing itself. I've inherited that completely. I think that, you know, if you're going to be a writer, then by God, don't tiptoe around things that make you uncomfortable. Because often the best writing is precisely in the most sort of difficult places.
There are quite a few passages in the book that I'm not comfortable asking you about. Not only as not wanting to have sort of spoilers in this interview, because reading the book is itself a process, not a linear one, but to come around to these discoveries. But I wonder if you can tell me, for example, about the significance of the cat in the well and how this appeared in your own writing and then you had a kind of epiphany about it.
Yeah, it's interesting because sometimes our books, the act of writing will reveal certain things to you that you weren't aware of even as you were writing it. In other words, your books can sort of reveal you, whether you're able to see it at that moment or not. My first novel was a book called God's Fool about the original Siamese twins, and in it I describe these two men waking up in South Carolina in, you know, 1868 or something, and hearing this weird wailing from outside in the dark, and eventually, because they can't sleep, they go out and find a cat that's drowning in a well. It's fallen into the well, it's been swimming as long as it can, and it's drowning. They pull it out, they try to warm it up, and it dies. And I just wrote that scene, and one of the things that I'd forgotten and blocked out is that I had that same exact thing happen to me when we were living in San Diego. I woke up in the middle of the night, I hear this bizarre kind of barking sound. Eventually I went to check, and I pulled this poor thing out of a well, and later it died. It didn't make it. We brought it to this veterinarian. It was too far gone. But then one thing opened another thing, and these doors kept opening. And a couple of years later, I had this epiphany, the sudden realization. I remembered being, I don't know how old I was, 19, 20, and my parents being here in Czechoslovakia at the time, and I was supposed to be the man of the house taking care of things, and our cat had a litter of kittens. And I'd been raised on these stories of, you know, the people in the country were sort of, they were an unsentimental lot, and, you know, if there were too many kittens, they'd put them in a bag with a rock and throw them in the river. Real men basically would take care of business, and they'd do what it had to do. So here I am, I'm by myself. I had this notion that, you know, I'm not weak like my father, as my mother loved to make that point. You know, I'm supposed to be a real man of the house. And after trying to give them away and failing and trying to find pet stores that would take them and failing, you know, I put them in a bucket of water and drowned them. And it was one of the most traumatic experiences of my life because of something I did not want to do, felt disgusted by, but pushed myself to do because of all this baggage that I'd sort of inherited about what masculinity is and da-da-da-da-da. And first of all, it was extraordinarily uncomfortable to write about it, but that's okay. But then I ran with it a bit, and I realized that really what made it so reprehensible was that I knew somewhere in my heart I knew it was wrong, that for me it was wrong. It was wrong to do this thing. And I did it anyway. And I realized at that moment that maybe a great many of the things that are done in this world that are cruel are often done by people who don't want to do them. But they do them anyway. They talk themselves into it, they rationalize it, they justify it. And so for just that moment, I haven't had many moments like that in my life, I can say that. But for just that moment, I kind of touched a kind of a darker part of myself, which I'm not proud of. So that's the story of the cat. And I think, everybody has moments that they choose not to look at in their past because it makes them uncomfortable or embarrassed. Part of the business of writing is unveiling, you know, look at it. This is real. It's just hidden underneath all these masks. Our job is to break through the mask, as Herman Melville once said.
And that was Mark Sloker talking to Brian Kennedy about his memoir, which sadly brings us to the end of our program here on Radio Prague Today. If you have any comments about today's program, then please send them to us. You can contact us by email at english@radio.cz or on Facebook and Twitter. We'll be glad to hear from you. But that's all for now from me, Tom McEncrow. Thank you very much for joining us, and goodbye.